The scene changed abruptly, just as it had when I was in the Sykes von Mew. I learned that he was called Siegfried, when one of the other miners at the entrance to the mine shaft called his name in German, which I understood perfectly, and I do not speak or understand that language. The other miner asked Siegfried to follow him. He headed towards an old shed, somewhat larger than all the others in this apparent main street of the village. I followed them both inside, where oil lamps were burning and men sat at tables. Siegfried joined a group of them. They shouted something at a brute wearing a dirty apron and, shortly afterwards, he brought them a bottle and some pewter goblets. Another scene was superimposed on this one. It seemed that it was several hours later. The shed was the same, but now, Siegfried was staggering out, visibly drunk. He headed towards a row of smaller sheds, all of which had chimneys from which blackish smoke curled. Brusquely, he opened the door of one of them and entered, with me hot on his heels. 8 children, progressing in ages from 1 year upwards, each 12 months apart, sat at a table plunging their spoons into bowls full of unappetizing-looking gruel. They all lifted their heads at the sudden appearance of their father, watching him with fearful eyes. A woman, medium in size but strong-looking, with hair of a dirty blonde color, addressed him aggressively, "Where have you been and where is the money? You know very well that the children haven't had bins in a fortnight, and, yet again, you're drunk." She rose and approached Siegfried. As she raised her hand to slap his face, he grabbed her arm and, with his left fist, punched her so hard that she was sent flying backwards. She fell to the floor, hitting the back of her neck on the chimney hearth as she did so, and was killed instantly. The children were crying and screaming. Siegfried leaned over his wife, whose wide open eyes stared lifelessly into his. "Frieda, Frieda, come on, get up," he cried, his voice filled with anguish. He took her in his arms to help her, but she couldn't stand. Suddenly, as she continued to stare fixedly, he realized she was dead. Sobered now, he rushed towards the door and fled into the night, running on and on, as if he had lost his mind. Again the scene changed and Siegfried appeared, firmly bound between 2 guards, one of whom was putting a hood over Siegfried's head. The executioner also wore one with holes cut in it for his eyes. He was a huge man and held within his enormous hand the handle of a wide blade axe. The guard made Siegfried kneel, bending forward so that his head rested on the execution block. Now the executioner came forward and assumed his position. A priest hastily recited prayers as the executioner slowly raised his axe over his head. Quite suddenly, he let it fall on the neck of Siegfried. The victim's head rolled across the ground, causing the crowd to recoil several steps. I had just witnessed the violent death of one of my many physical bodies. The sensation was so strange. Until the moment of his death, I had been filled with a great fondness for this man, and although he had done wrong, I felt great pity for him. At the moment of his death, however, as his head rolled across the ground amid the murmurs of the crowd, I felt an overwhelming sense of relief, on his account as well as my own. Immediately, I was presented with another scene. Before me was a lake, its shining blue waters reflecting the rays of 2 suns which hung quite low on the horizon. A small boat, richly yet delicately decorated with sculptures and paintings, proceeded across the lake. It was guided by men, of medium size and reddish complexion, using long poles which they plunged into the water. Beneath a type of canopy and seated on an ornately decorated throne, was a lovely young woman with golden skin. Her oval-shaped face was lit up by pretty almond eyes and long blonde hair that fell to her waist. She was relaxed and smiling as the young company, which hovered around her, entertained her light-heartedly. I knew instantly that this pretty creature was myself in another life. The boat proceeded steadily towards a landing pier, from which led a wide pathway bordered by tiny flowering shrubs. This path disappeared among trees that surrounded what appeared to be a palace, with roofs at various levels and of various colors. With a change of scene, I was transported inside the palace to find myself in a lavishly decorated room. One wall opened up onto a garden, a very orderly miniature garden of astonishing variety and color. Servants with reddish skin, dressed in bright green loincloths, busied themselves with serving 100 or so guests. These guests were of both sexes and all richly dressed. They had the same type of light golden skin color as the woman on the boat. In contrast to the complexions of the servants, these people had skins of the color that blonde women on Earth can attain after numerous sun tanning sessions. The pretty young woman from the boat sat, in what appeared to be the place of honor, in a high-backed seat. Music, soft and enchanting, could be heard and seemed to emanate from the far end of the room as well as from the garden. One of the servants opened a large door to admit a tall young man, perhaps 190 centimeters in height and of similar golden complexion. His bearing was proud and his build athletic. Copper blonde hair framed a face of regular features. He advanced with a purposeful stride towards the young woman and bowed before her. Whispering something to him, she gestured to the servants who brought forward an armchair similar to her own and placed it beside hers. The young man sat down and the woman gave him her hand, which he held in his. Suddenly, on a signal from her, a gong sounded several times, and silence fell. The guests turned towards the couple. In a voice loud and clear, directed towards the servants as well as the guests, the young woman spoke, "To all of you gathered here, I want you to know that I have chosen a companion. This is he, Xenolini, and he will have, from this moment and according to my agreement, all the royal rights and privileges, after me. Indeed, he will be the second power in the kingdom, after myself, the queen and the head. Any subject disobeying him or doing wrong by him in any way will answer to me. The first child that I bear, Xenolini, whether male or female, will be my successor. I, Labinola, queen of the land, have decided this." She signaled again, and the sound of the gong indicated the end of her speech. One by one, the guests bowed low before Labinola, kissing first her feet and then Xenolini's in gestures of subservience. This scene disappeared in a blur to be replaced by another, in the same palace but another room, where the royal family sat in thrones. Here, Labinola was administering justice. All sorts of people paraded before the queen and she listened attentively to them all. An extraordinary thing happened. I found I was able to enter into her body. It's quite difficult to explain, but for a considerable time, while I listened and watched, I was Labinola. I could understand absolutely all that was said, and when Labinola pronounced her judgment, I was in total agreement with her decisions. I could hear in the murmuring of the crowd, reflections of admiration for her wisdom. Never once did she turn towards Xenolini and never did she ask his advice. I felt a great pride invade me, knowing that I had been this woman in another life and I felt, during this time, the light tingling sensation that I was starting to recognize. Everything disappeared again and then I was in the most luxurious of bedrooms. It proved to be that of Labinola, who lay, completely naked, on the bed. Three women and two men hovered nearby. As I approached, I could see her face, streaming with perspiration and disfigured with the pain of labor. The women, midwives, and the men, the most eminent doctors in the kingdom, seemed worried. The child was arriving in a breech position and Labinola had lost a lot of blood. This was her first child and she was exhausted. Fear was evident in the eyes of the midwives and doctors and I knew that Labinola already realized she was going to die. The scene moved forwards 2 hours in time and Labinola had just breathed her last breath. She had lost too much blood. The child, too, had died, suffocating before it could merge into the world. Labinola, this pretty creature of 28 years, so beautiful and good, had just released her astral body, my astral body, to live another life. Further scenes were already appearing, revealing other lives on other planets, as men, women and children. Twice I was a beggar, and three times a sailor. I was a water carrier in India, a goldsmith in Japan where I lived till 95 years of age, a Roman soldier, a black child at Chad devoured by a lion at the age of 8 years, an Indian fisherman on the Amazon, dead at 42 years leaving 12 children, an Apache chief dead at 86 years, several times a peasant farmer, on Earth as well as on other planets, and twice an ascetic in the mountains of Tibet and on another planet. Apart from when I was Labanola, ruling queen of one third of a planet, most of my lives were very modest. I saw scenes from all 80 of my previous lives, some of which impressed me a lot. I do not have time to detail them all in this book, as they would fill a volume on their own. Maybe one day I will write it. At the end of the show, I had the impression of moving backwards in the tunnel and, when I opened my eyes, Thou and the three Thari were smiling kindly. When it was established that I was indeed back in my present skin, the leader addressed me in the following words: "We wanted to show you your past lives, that you might notice they vary, as though they were attached to a wheel. Because a wheel is made to turn, any point on it that is on top will soon be at the bottom. It is inevitable. Do you see? One day you are a beggar and then you can be a queen, such as Labanola, who, of course, was not only at the top of the wheel but also learned a lot and greatly helped others. And yet, in many cases, a beggar will learn as much as a king, and in some instances he will learn much more. When you were an ascetic in the mountains, you assisted many more individuals than in most of your other lives. What counts most is not appearances, but what is behind them. When your astral body takes on another physical body, it is, quite simply, in order to learn more, and even more. As we have explained to you, it is for the sake of your higher self. It is a process of continual refinement, which can occur just as effectively in the body of a beggar as in that of a king or a miner. The physical body is but a tool. A sculptor's chisel and hammer are tools. They will never reach beauty on their own, but they contribute to it in the hands of an artist. A wonderful statue could not have been created with the artist's bare hands. You should always bear in mind this main point: an astral body, in all cases, must conform to universal law, and, by following nature as closely as possible, it can achieve the ultimate goal by the fastest path." With that, the Thari resumed their places and we resumed ours. During my stay in the Doko, the sun had set, however, they didn't deem it necessary to explain the luminous ambience that allowed us to see at least 15 meters in distance inside the Doko. My attention was still focused on the Thari. They were looking at me with kindness, surrounded by a golden mist that became more and more dense, into which they disappeared, just as they had on my first visit. This time, Thou gently placed her hand on my shoulder and asked me to follow her. She led me towards the entrance of the Doko, and in an instant we were outside. It was completely dark and no light shone anywhere apart from over the entrance. I could see no more than 3 meters in front of me and wondered how we were going to find the flying platform. I then remembered that Thou could see as well by night as by day. I was curious to see evidence of this. Like a typical earthling, I sought proof. It was provided immediately. Thou lifted me up effortlessly and sat me on her shoulders, just as we on Earth carry our little ones. You could stumble, she explained, as we proceeded along the path, and indeed, she seemed to know exactly where she was going, just as though it were daylight. Before long, she put me down on the seat of the Lativok and sat herself next to me. I placed my mask, which I had been holding in my hand, on my knees, and almost immediately we took off. I must say that, in spite of my confidence in Thou, I felt uneasy at flying blind. We flew between the immense trees of the park and I couldn't even see the stars that usually shone so brightly. Great clouds had formed after sundown and our surroundings were completely obscured in darkness. Next to me, however, I could see Thou's aura and the bouquet at the top of her head, which was particularly bright. We picked up speed and I'm sure we traveled as fast in the darkness as we did by day. I felt some drops of rain sting my face. Thou moved her hand towards a point on the machine and I felt the rain no more. At the same instant, I had the impression that we were stopping and I wondered what was happening, for I knew we were over the ocean. Occasionally, in the distance on our left, I could make out colored lights that moved. "What is it?" I asked Thao. "The lights at the entrances to the dokos on the coast." I was trying to understand why the dokos were moving, when suddenly, through the darkness which seemed even thicker, a light came directly towards us and stopped beside us. "We are at your place," said Thao. "Come on." She lifted me again. I felt a slight pressure as when one enters a doko and then felt the rain fall on my face. The downpour was very strong but, in a few strides, Thao was under the light and we entered the doko. "We got here just in time," I remarked. "Why?
For the rain?"
"No, it's actually been pouring for a short while now. I activated the force field, didn't you notice? You stopped feeling the wind, didn't you?" "Yes, but I thought we had stopped. I don't understand at all." Thao burst into laughter, which put me at ease again and suggested that the explanation to the mystery was about to unfold. "The force field not only keeps the rain out but also the wind, so you had no reference point by which to judge whether we moved or not. You see, one must not rely on perception." "But how could you find this place in such darkness?" "As I told you, we can see as well by night as by day. That's why we don't use lighting. I realize that is not convenient for you, you can't see me now, but, in any case, we have had a very full day and I think it would be best for you to rest now. Let me help you." She led me to the relaxation area, wishing me a good night. I asked her if she was going to stay with me, but she explained that she lived quite nearby, not even requiring the vehicle to transport her there. With that, she left and I stretched out and soon fell asleep. The next morning, I awoke to the sound of Thao's voice as she leaned over me, whispering in my ear. I observed as I had the first time, that this relaxation area was well deserving of its name, for I would not have heard Thao, had she not leaned over me to speak, sound being extremely muffled here. Further, I had slept soundly, without waking once. I was perfectly rested. I got up and followed Thao towards the pool. It was at this time that she told me of the accident that had befallen Aki. I was greatly saddened by the news and tears sprang to my eyes. Thao reminded me that Aki was proceeding to another existence and should be remembered as a friend who has left us to go elsewhere. "Indeed it is sad, but we must not be selfish, Michelle. Other adventures and other joys are probably in store for Aki." I washed and when I rejoined Thao, we enjoyed a very light meal and drank some hydromel. I didn't feel hungry. Looking up, I could see the grey sky and the rain falling on the doko. It was interesting to watch, as the raindrops didn't stream down the doko as they would have done over a glass dome. Instead, they simply disappeared when they reached the doko's force field. I looked at Thao and she smiled at me, having seen my surprise. "The drops are dislocated by the force field, Michelle. It is elementary physics, at least for us. But there are more interesting things to study and, unfortunately, you have so little time. There are still more things that I must teach you, so your fellow men might be enlightened when you write your book, such as the mystery of Christ which I mentioned yesterday when we were interrupted by Aki's arrival. First, I must speak to you of Egypt and Israel, as well as of Atlantis, the famous continent so often talked of on Earth and the subject of so much controversy. Atlantis, like the continent of Mu, did exist and was situated in the northern hemisphere, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It was attached to Europe, and linked to America by an isthmus and to Africa by another isthmus at about the latitude of the Canary Islands. Its area was slightly greater than that of Australia. It was inhabited by the people of Mu, approximately 30,000 years ago. In fact, it was a colony of Mu. There was also a white race there, tall blonde people with blue eyes. It was the Mayas, very learned colonizers from Mu, who governed the country, and they constructed there, a replica of the Pyramid of Savanazar. 17,000 years ago, they explored the Mediterranean thoroughly, going via the north of Africa where they acquainted the Arabs, descendants of the crossbreeding between yellow and black Bakaratinians, with much new knowledge, material as well as spiritual. The numerical script, for example, still used by the Arabs, came from Atlantis, and from Mu, of course. They went to Greece where they founded a small colony and the Greek alphabet corresponds almost exactly to that of Mu. Finally they arrived in a land that the natives called Aranka and which you know as Egypt. There, they established a strong colony with a great man, by the name of Thoth, at its head. Laws were established which embodied the beliefs of Mu and the organizational principles of Atlantis. Improved plants, new techniques for raising cattle, new methods of cultivation, pottery and weaving were all introduced. Thoth was a great man of Atlantis, extremely knowledgeable materially as well as spiritually. He founded villages, built temples and, just before his death, he had constructed what you now call the Great Pyramid. Each time these great colonizers judged that the new colony had the potential to become great, materially and spiritually, they would construct a special pyramid, a tool, as you were able to see for yourself on Mu. In Egypt, they constructed the Great Pyramid on the same model as the Pyramid of Savanazar, but on a scale 3 times reduced. These pyramids are unique and, in order to fulfill their role as a tool, their dimensions and specifications must be precisely adhered to, as well as their orientation. Do you know how much time it took? It was quite fast, just 9 years, for Thoth and his master architects knew the secrets of anti-gravitation from Mu, and the secrets for cutting the rock and using, let's call them electro-ultrasounds. But on Earth, the experts believe it to have been constructed by the pharaoh Cheops. It's not so, Michel. Of course, this is not the only mistake that the experts on Earth have made. On the other hand, I can confirm that the pharaoh Cheops used this pyramid as it was meant to be used. The Maya Atlanteans were not the only ones to explore and colonize. Gone for thousands of years, the Nagas had colonized Burma, India and finally they reached the shores of Egypt, at about the latitude of the Tropic of Cancer. They too, founded a successful colony and occupied Upper Egypt. Both groups of colonizers introduced similar sorts of improvements. The Nagas established a large town called Ma, on the banks of the Red Sea. The natives of the region went to their schools, gradually becoming assimilated with the colonists and producing the Egyptian race. However, about 5,000 years ago, the Nagas in the north of Egypt and the Maya Atlanteans began fighting for a reason that is quite ludicrous. The Atlanteans, whose religion differed significantly from the religion of Mu, believed in the reincarnation of the soul, astral body, in the country of its ancestors. Thus, they claimed that the soul traveled westward to where they had come from. The Nagas held a similar belief except that they claimed the soul went back to the east, since they had come from the east. For 2 years they were actually at war over this difference, but it was not a terribly cruel war, as both groups comprised of fundamentally peace-loving people, and eventually they became allied and formed a unified Egypt. The first king of united Egypt, both upper and lower, was called Mena. It was he who established the town of Memphis. He was elected by the same method used in Mu, a method that did not long survive in Egypt, due to the rise of a powerful clergy which little by little put the pharaohs under its thumb. This situation continued over the years with notable exceptions among the pharaohs who yielded to the clergy. One such exception was the pharaoh Akhenaten, who was poisoned by the priests. Before dying, he made the following statement: "The time that I have spent on this earth was an era in which the simplicity of truth was not understood and was rejected by many." As often happens in religious sects, the Egyptian priests distorted the truth, simple though it was, in order to have a better hold over the people. They had them believing in the devil and in various divine beings as well as other such nonsense. It must also be said that prior to the war and the subsequent peace pact which saw Manu installed as king of Egypt, the population, made up of Maya Atlanteans and Nagas in equal proportions, had established a sophisticated civilization in both Upper and Lower Egypt. The country was prosperous. Farming and grazing flourished, and there, time of the first king of Egypt, Mena, was almost the culmination of this rising civilization. Now, at this point, we must go back in time. Arki said that Earth is still being visited by extraterrestrials and, as you know, it has been regularly visited in the past. But, I should elaborate on this. Earth is visited, as are many other inhabitable planets scattered throughout the universe. Sometimes the inhabitants of certain planets are obliged to evacuate as their planet is dying. Now, as Arki also explained, you can't change planets as you might change houses. You must conform to a cycle that is well established, otherwise, catastrophes can be the consequence. This is what happened 12,000 years ago. Human beings left the planet Hebra in order to explore the galaxy in search of a new planet of the same category as their own, for they knew that, in the millennium to come, their planet would become totally uninhabitable. A spacecraft, capable of extremely high speeds, experienced serious problems during its reconnaissance flight and was obliged to land on your planet. It landed in the region of Krasnodar, a town in western Russia. Needless to say, at the time there was no town, no people, no Russia. On board the spacecraft were 8 astronauts, 3 women and 5 men. These people were approximately 170 centimeters in height, with black eyes, fair skin and long brown hair. They made a successful landing and began repairs to their vessel. They found the gravitational force stronger than on their own planet and, initially, had some difficulty moving about. They established a camp near their spacecraft, expecting repairs to take some time. One day, during work, an accident occurred causing a terrific explosion that destroyed half of the vessel and killed 5 of the cosmonauts. The other 3, being some distance away, were unharmed. They were Obannon, a man, and Livia and Dinah, 2 women. They knew well what was in store for them. Coming from a planet of a superior category, they did not belong on Earth, where they were in fact prisoners, and thus they anticipated the misadventures that befell them. The accident came as no great surprise. For several months, the 3 remained at the spot, for the season was warm. They had some weapons and they were able to procure game, their provisions of manna and raustine having been lost in the explosion. Eventually the cold arrived and they decided to move further south. The gravitational force made walking long distances extremely difficult for them, so that their trek south to warmer climates became a veritable road to Calvary. They passed by the Black Sea heading in the direction of today's Israel. The journey took months, but they were young people and, astonishingly, they made it. The weather became more clement, and even hot, as they reached lower latitudes. They stopped by a river, establishing there a permanent camp, all the more permanent since Dinah was several months pregnant. At full term, she gave birth to a son whom they named Ranan. By then, Livia too was pregnant, and some time later, she also bore a son, Rabian. These people from Hebra acclimatized in this spot, which was rich in game, honey and edible plants, and there they founded their line. It was quite some time later that they made the acquaintance of some nomads passing by. This was their first contact with Earthlings. The nomads numbered 10 and, having found Robannon's women to their liking, they wanted to kill him and take all that he had, including the women. Robannon still had his weapon and, although a pacifist, he was obliged to use it and killed 4 of his attackers who fled in the face of such power. These people were greatly saddened that they had to resort to such a measure, and saw in it yet another sign that they were on a planet that was forbidden to them by universal law. "I don't understand," I interrupted. I thought that it wasn't possible to jump categories in a forward direction, but that it would be possible to go to inferior planets. "No, Michelle, neither forwards nor backwards. If you go forward, disregarding universal law, you will die. If you go backwards, you expose yourself to worse conditions because your advanced spirituality can't exist in a materialistic environment. If you like, I can give you an analogy in the form of a childish comparison. Imagine a man immaculately dressed in polished shoes, white socks and pressed suit. You oblige this man to walk through a farmyard, 30 centimeters deep in mud.